last case, which is our last case for today and for the week. It is case number 20-13542, Randall Greer versus Wayne Ivey et al. And Mr. Davis, we'll start with you whenever you're ready. Take your time.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Michael Davis, Ben Cuny, and Douglas Beam here on behalf of the estate of Christopher Greer. On January 13, 2013, Christopher Greer was shot to death while home alone after law enforcement officers fired 13 rounds at his closed and closing door. This court in the original appeal identified the principal question in this case. Was the use of deadly force reasonable? In addition to identifying the core issue in the case, the court also explained that the answer to this question under both federal law and state law turned on one factor and one factor alone. That is, did the deputies reasonably believe in the moment before the shooting that Christopher Greer posed an immediate threat to their safety? In my argument today, I'll address three of the errors that denied the estate a full and fair trial on this question. And real quick, the three issues are, one, the federal instruction. The estate's proposed instruction correctly stated the law governing this case. In contrast, the court's grant instruction was a misstatement of the applicable law, and it had the potential of misleading the jury. Second, the requirement that the state choose between either its state law claim or federal law claim was legally erroneous, and it denied the estate a trial on the state law claim. And finally, I'll address the third issue, which is the admission of evidence that the state attorney declined to prosecute the officers. That evidence was highly prejudicial and erroneously admitted, and as every circuit court to address this issue has concluded, its admission was reversible error. Turning to the first issue, the legal issue raised by both the complaint as well as the evidence at trial was the reasonableness of deadly force in self-defense. And under this court's precedent, as we cite in our brief, Perez, Smith, Salvado, as well as the first appeal, the reasonableness of the use of deadly force in self-defense is a one-factor analysis.
To distill your position, as I understand it from the briefs, is that the instruction actually given by the district court improperly inserted the issue of arrest into the equation because this was not an arrest scenario, right? I mean, I'm summarizing, of course, but that's the essence of your position, right?
So that's the second point with respect to prejudice. So the instruction proposed by the estate was a correct statement of the law. It was supported by the facts garnered at trial. And the sole question is whether there was prejudice. And I think with respect to prejudice, there's two ways to look at it. The second part that Judge Jordan has referenced is that the complaint did not raise a lawful arrest case, right? The claim raised in the complaint, presented at trial and litigated for 5 years, was not the lawfulness of force while making a lawful arrest. The sole issue is whether the officers acted in self-defense.
And so can I ask you a question just about the lawful arrest bit? What's the evidence or even the argument that that would have mattered? Like, how would that have changed the jury's calculation, whether or not this was an arrest scenario? I mean, I think at least very arguably, whether it was formally an arrest or not, there might have been probable cause to arrest him anyway. So we might be in arrest land anyway. But even if we weren't, how would that have mattered to the jury's determination?
Well, two things. I want to make sure the record is clear. In the pretrial statement, neither of the parties asked that the jury be instructed on lawful arrest.
Right.
Everyone agreed this was not the claim pled. So I think the first issue is that, one, the estate was not given a trial or verdict on the issue raised in the complaint. Two, with respect to lawful arrest under Graham v. Connor, the Supreme Court explained that when the police are making a lawful seizure, some amount of force is required. But I do want to make sure that I go to the first issue, which I think is our primary argument. The Graham instruction is a four-factor test. So when the court gives the Graham instruction, the court directs the jury to consider factors beyond the question of whether Christopher Greer posed an immediate threat of harm to the officers.
The other, I mean, I'm with Judge Newsom on this. I think from what he said, the other factors, I don't see how they harm you at all, because those are, they're going to be present. The existence of the instruction on the other Graham factors is not going to be a problem for you, given the way that this case played out, given our ruling on the interlocutory appeal. That's why I thought that the essence of your claim on the jury instruction was that it allegedly improperly inserted the concept of arrest into the equation, where a false arrest was not pled, the parties hadn't litigated the issue, and then all of a sudden the word arrest pops up in the jury instruction. I thought that was the essence of the claim, but maybe I have it wrong.
Yes, Your Honor, that is the essence of the claim with respect to the lawfulness of the arrest. So the court told the jury that the officers were conducting a lawful arrest, and that because they were conducting a lawful arrest, the court should give them a presumption of rightfulness in going inside of the home. That mattered for the state law sovereign immunity claim. But with respect to the four-factor Graham instruction.
Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, let me ask you this. Suppose the court had said the lawfulness of the seizure. Tell them that shooting someone has been held by the Supreme Court to be a seizure, the ultimate seizure. And the question is the lawfulness of that a seizure here. And the rest of the instruction was as given. Did you have a problem with that?
Well, it would still be the lawfulness, Your Honor, because the court actually excluded evidence of the question of lawfulness because
I'm sorry. Evidence.
But assuming what there's evidence of it.
What factor of lawfulness? What factor? If the force used was reasonable and the force was deadly, and if an objective officer would have found that it was reasonable, it's an objective test. What else is there from Graham or otherwise that is at play in this case?
Well, I think here, Your Honor, two things. One, the jury was told to consider the acts of resistance. So the jury heard evidence that Christopher Greer slammed the door in the officer's face, refused to come outside. All of that was resistance evidence. And the court's instruction that gave the Graham instruction told the jury to consider the acts of resistance in deciding whether the use of deadly force is reasonable. The jury was also told
isn't that self-evident?
Well, no, Your Honor, that's not.
If you've got a person with their hands up who isn't moving, says, I give up, zero resistance, and you shoot him, that's different from if the person has a knife advancing. I mean, what's wrong with that?
I want to move to the other points, but I would ask the court to look at Ron v. Hawkins. This is the Eighth Circuit's decision in 2004. They answered that question. They said that when the court gives the four-factor Graham instruction in a deadly force case where there's only one factor, there is a possibility that the jury will be misled. The court explained, one can easily imagine a jury getting the four-factor Graham instruction that I've talked about and finding that the officer was objectively reasonable in shooting a fleeing suspect who posed no threat to the officers or others. If I may move to the second issue, which is the state law claim. The district court erroneously required the estate to choose between its state law claims and federal law claims. There was
Did the district court ever provide counsel on either side or both sides with the case law that the law clerk had supposedly uncovered?
No, Your Honor. And as the briefs reflect, no one was able ever to find that. And that was prejudicial error. The court denied the motion for a directed verdict with respect to the state law claim, which meant that the court found, looking at the evidence, there was an issue of fact for the jury to resolve.
That's the overarching issue that is troubling to me in this case, because let's assume, and this is only an assumption, but assuming that we affirm across the board on your appeal, theoretically you would have the state law claims available, because those were not tried, but you'd be facing all sorts of issues and difficult questions about the application of collateral estoppel? Like, what was necessarily decided by the jury in this case, even though the standards for the state law claims are not the same as the standard for the federal, you know, excessive force claim?
Well, so that issue wasn't raised, but just off of the top of my head, there would not be a collateral issue because the elements for the state law claims are different than the federal law.
No, the collateral estoppel on the factual side. So if you go back for trial on the state law claims, there's going to be a claim on the other side that some of your factual assertions to a jury are barred by the doctrine of collateral estoppel based on the first verdict.
I think that'll be an issue.
And the question is going to be a very difficult one of what was necessarily decided by the jury in rendering the first. Was it a general verdict?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the question is going to be a very hard one of trying to figure out what in the world was necessarily decided by that jury in rendering a verdict on the federal excessive force claim. And what, if anything, is left on the state law claim, notwithstanding the difference in the two legal standards?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can I ask you a question just in answer, and we'll give you your time, but I think I need some tutorial about how the standards for the two claims, federal and state, are different, and why it is that the determination by the jury here that the exercise of force was reasonable wouldn't likewise nuke the state law claim.
So two things. The easy answer is the court could look at the proposed instructions by both parties. So I think the proposed instructions make clear that they're different elements. So
just walk me through them. What are
they? Sure. Yeah. So for the assault and battery claim, the elements are, you know, reasonable apprehension of an assault, fear that that's going to happen, and then for the battery claim, it's the unintentional, or rather, the touching him without permission. The question of self-defense, the question of whether they were using force or making a lawful arrest, is then an affirmative defense that the other side has to allege and prove.
So help me with this. So if you're in a purely state law claim, if you're adjudicating or litigating a purely state law claim, and the jury comes back with a finding that the officer's use of force was reasonable, can you still survive on your state law assault and battery claim?
Yes, Your Honor. Because one, right, the elements are different. The burdens of proof are different. So whereas with the federal claim, the plaintiff bears the burden of proving that the use of deadly force was not reasonable, under the state law claim, the defendant bears the burden of proving that the state law claim was reasonable.
I'm thinking about, let's just like fast forward to the end of the trial. Now we've got a jury verdict. And the jury says that the officer's use, without respect to who had the burdens, we find as a matter of fact that the officer's use of force was reasonable. Does your state law claim survive? Can your state law claim survive that jury verdict?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why?
Well, because the jury instructions, the jury would have been directed differently with respect to the federal claim, whereas a jury properly instructed on the state law claims could come to a different conclusion because the element.
So you're
wait,
what you're
wait,
saying.
Wait, no.
What you're saying is that.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Judge Carnes.
I'm sorry. That makes no sense. What you're saying is a state court jury could find, and the jury and the state court judge and the appellate court would uphold a finding that an officer had committed assault and battery, even though the officer had only used reasonable force to make the arrest. That does not make any sense, and I cannot believe that is the law of the state.
So I'm not necessarily talking about with respect to the arrest. I might not understand the question, but with respect to...
Pick one. Pick one. What state law claim could the jury be instructed? It has been stipulated, found, you are to take as a fact, not quarrel with, take as a fact that the use of force was reasonable. Which of those state law claims would survive even though the use of force was reasonable and only reasonable?
Yeah, so with respect to the question of a stipulation of fact, I think under that hypothetical—
Oh, for gosh sakes, counsel, don't argue with me. I'm saying if it's stipulated, if it's taken out of the case, if the force is reasonable, we start with that premise for purposes of this question only. I'm not asking you to stipulate it. if it's found in this case, and it's binding, that it was reasonable use of force, what state law claim survives that finding?
In other words, does a reasonable use of force preclude, a finding of a reasonable use of force preclude a battery and assault claim, for example, under state law?
I don't know the precise answer to that question, but I think thinking out loud and looking to the appellee's brief, I think the answer turns on whether the jury's verdict is a reflection of the sovereign immunity issue with respect to sovereign immunity. So for example, here in this case, the defendants have taken the position that since the verdict determined that the use of deadly force was reasonable, that also meant that the officers did not act in bad faith or for malicious purpose, or with wanton and willful disregard of human rights or safety. Our response to that argument, if I'm framing the question correctly, our response is that under the facts of this case, where you have the police going inside of the home with the ballistic shell, you're breaking through a home of a mentally ill person, they had no reason to go in there, that a jury could still determine that the officers did not act with, that the officers' conduct was malicious, that the officers' conduct exhibited wanton and willful disregard for human rights.
So I'll just speak for myself. I think we might have kind of like jumped issues. I think the question that all three of us are trying to get an answer to, and maybe it's best for you to just kind of think about it and you can talk to us about it on rebuttal, but is whether the jury here found, right, that the officer's use of force was reasonable. You're saying that the judge erred in forcing you to choose. Are you going the Fourth Amendment route or are you going the state law route? And the questions I think are, maybe that was a mistake. Did it matter? Did it matter because you've got a finding here that the use of force was reasonable? So, like, you can't survive that either on the federal side or the state side. That's, I think, the question.
So think about it, and we'll give you a chance to talk to us in rebuttal.
Oh, good. And, you know, in closing, I just do remind the court the erroneous admission of the non-prosecution.
All of your issues in the brief are preserved. There's no way you can get to all of them in a case like this one in your time, even though we've taken you beyond it. So thank you very much, Mr. Davis, and you've saved your time for rebuttal. Who's going first, Mr. Bogan?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
These things.
Okay, Mr. Bogan, Mr. Davis got the hard questions about why it matters. So now I want to ask you the hard question, which is the antecedent question, which we may or may not have to reach, but I want to ask it to you. What in the world happened with this district court judge at trial? I have never seen state law claims, federal law claims, all arising from the same common nucleus of operative fact, severed mid-trial. What in the world happened? And I'm not blaming you for any of it. I'm just trying to wrap my head around this. I have never seen this. I mean, every once in a while, a defendant in any sort of a case will say, listen, the evidence on issue one is so prejudicial on issue two that it contaminates and you need to sever. I get that. But that's not this case because everything is the same. Everything's about the use of force, which is the hard question to Mr. Davis. But how in the world, what happened to the extent you can shed any light on it? Because I know it came from the court, not from you, but.
So I believe the court obviously made a determination that the central issue in the case was exactly what the jury had to answer on the verdict form, and I have the verdict form right here, and the first question was, do you find by preponderance of evidence that any one of the defendants intentionally committed acts that violated the plaintiff's federal constitutional right not to be subjected to excessive or unreasonable force during an arrest which caused the plaintiff injury? With both defendants. And based on that, the court obviously, my interpretation is that their view was that issue resolved both any federal and state law claims.
If they had chosen the state law claim instead of the federal claim, what would have been the result?
It would have been the same result.
because you're asking for excessive force as defined under Fourth Amendment law on the state law claims, and you've got state law immunity.
Well,
potentially,
other than it would
768.
I agree. It would not say federal constitutional right. It would say whether the officer committed a battery by using more force than reasonably necessary. And that's essentially the same standard. That's exactly what the jury would have had to have decided. So obviously the advantage to the plaintiff to pick the Fourth Amendment case is that there's no statutory cap. You don't have the state law statutory immunity issue to deal with, because the second question then, if it really was only going to be under state law, once they decided if yes, excessive force was going to be found that it did occur, then the jury would have to decide, did the officers have statutory immunity from terms of willful, wanton, and bad faith? So it's a tougher challenge for them to go that route. And obviously, it's harmless error in our position, because the finding here is that the jury says the force was reasonable. And so whether you went state law or you went federal law, the result was going to be the same. It's a defense verdict.
But so is your answer to Judge Jordan's question about the antecedent issue here, the district court requiring the severance of the election in the first instance, is your real answer to say, I have no defense for that. It was a mistake, but it was harmless. You're not really defending that judgment, are you? I shouldn't say judgment, that decision to proceed in that manner.
I agree. It's not what I had envisioned was going to be, submitted in terms of how the case would proceed, but it's harmless. If it was an error, it's harmless. And the outcome is going to be the same. If there was another verdict question here for the state law, it's going to be the same. And so under the circumstances, there's going to be no different outcome in this case, whether both the state and federal claims were both put on that verdict form. So now
if they try to go back and try the state law claims, your argument would be what?
If they went back and tried the same, I would actually go back and tell the court that this is the law of the case. That, in other words,
it binds them, and there's nothing else to try.
There's nothing left to try.
Because of collateral estoppel or res judicata.
Absolutely correct. That would be our position if the state law claim had to be remanded. And so I think it's been decided, and there's nothing left to try. You can't have excessive force under a battery, and you have no constitutional violation under the Fourth Amendment for the use of excessive force. So, it's our position, realistically, that even though the judge made that decision, it's harmless, and the outcome would be the same.
Now, the same sort of antecedent question for you on the jury instruction. So, Judge Carnes asked Mr. Davis why it mattered that the instruction, why it matters that this instruction is harmful or not. So, my question to you is, neither side proposed inclusion of language, including an arrest or during the course of an arrest, in their proposed jury instructions on the excessive force claim. The district court put it in there anyways. Do you think that was right, wrong?
So the district, I proposed that he was being taken into custody, which is what, how this started out. The testimony from the officer who actually is the officer who was called, pursuant to a 911 call by the Greer family, saying that Mr. Greer had just threatened his brother with a knife and choked his wife. And so that officer responded to this call. And his testimony at trial was that he spoke to his supervisor, and they had decided that Mr. Greer was going to be taken into custody, and he was going to jail first because he had committed two violent felonies. And then at that point, they would decide what was going to happen in terms of, a Baker Act or not. But the first thing was he was being taken into custody, and he was going to be arrested for those two violent felonies. So that was the testimony that I believe that the judge determined that this really was an arrest, even though we're not dealing with an unlawful arrest claim. So the judge, in his view, at least I'm not speaking for him, but I think what he characterizes that this is a situation where the guy was being arrested for all intents and purposes, and it makes more sense to use the word arrest that is in that pattern 11th circuit jury instruction instead of what the plaintiff wanted. I think we asked for taken into custody. I think they wanted the word police encounter, and the judge used the word arrest. So again, I don't believe it was an inaccurate statement of what was going on based on the evidence that was produced at the time of the trial, that he really was in a situation where he was going to be arrested. But unfortunately, you know, the circumstances were presented. He came at them with a knife and he was shot and killed.
Can I ask you another question about the instruction? So the other piece of it, Mr. Davis said, look, there are two pieces. There's the insinuation of the arrest language, and then there's the failure to use deadly force specific instruction, I'll call it, and instead to use just the ordinary Graham excessive force. I'm frankly sympathetic, I think, signaling to Mr. Davis, I guess, for his rebuttal, that it doesn't so much matter because Garner is really just an application of Graham, and the Supreme Court in Harris versus Garner says, or in Harris versus Scott says, this is all just sort of a reasonableness analysis. But what about the fact he's got a law of the case argument? What about the fact that our earlier decision on appeal said that the key question will be whether in the moment before the shooting the deputies reasonably believed that Christopher posed an immediate threat to their safety? And he says, secondarily, alternatively, forget about Graham, forget about Garner, forget about Harris. I've got a law of the case entitlement to that instruction. What about that?
So I don't recall that the, I guess that's what the instruction or the 11th Circuit's opinion, you know, stated. I don't recall that was a direction that had to be the instruction to the jury.
No, I think his position is the 11th Circuit is just saying, rightly or wrongly, that's what the Fourth Amendment law is. And then you would expect the district court to instruct accurately on what the law is.
And I think the law was accurately instructed as it relates to the Fourth Amendment and the Graham analysis that a jury is supposed to go through in deciding whether any force is reasonably necessary.
Yeah, I'm just asking a slightly different question. Like, there's a gloss or an overlay on this case because it's not, he says anyway, it's not necessarily just sort of like the Fourth Amendment doctrine in the abstract. You've got this overlay of this intervening appellate court decision from us saying, like, here's the standard. And he says, for purposes of this case, that's how the Fourth Amendment standard gets operationalized.
And I guess my response to you is I think the instruction that was given doesn't necessarily conflict with what the court said in terms of that opinion at the summary judgment stage of the case. I think that the court in the district court correctly gave what the jury is supposed to consider as it relates to analyzing a Fourth Amendment use of force case. The issue that we have to give a separate deadly force instruction as it relates to a police shooting case, I believe that is not required in the 11th Circuit, and I think that's a slippery slope for the court now to decide that, you know, we're going to require a separate instruction depending on what the police use of force is. If it's a deadly force shooting, then we need to have a deadly force instruction. If it's a taser case, now we have to have a different analysis as it relates to whether the force was objectively reasonable under the circumstances. I think that the way it is currently now and that the Graham factors being used is the most logical and the most appropriate way for a jury to analyze using those four factors and deciding whether the officer's use of force was appropriate and reasonable under the circumstances. And I think that's exactly what was done in this case.
All right, Mr. Bogan, thank you so much. Is it Jafreda?
It's Jafreda, yes, Your Honor.
Whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Judge. My name is Richard Jafreda with the law firm of Purdy Jolly, Jafreda Branco and Gisa in Fort Lauderdale. I represent Deputy Canella. I would like to start off with the jury instruction issue. This court's the Greer 1 opinion at 767 Fed Appendix 706, 2019 opinion, noted that federal and Florida law turn on whether in the moment before the shooting the deputies reasonably believed that Christopher posed an immediate threat to their safety. The court cited several federal opinions and City of Miami versus Saunders, which is the case we typically cite for the proposition that there's no such thing as a negligent use of excessive force. And City of Miami versus Saunders indicates that a battery claim for excessive force is analyzed by focusing upon whether the amount of force used was reasonable under the circumstances. So typically what happens with police officers, there's a privilege to use force to make an arrest or a seizure. And certainly seizures come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. A Baker Act is a seizure under the Fourth Amendment. You have to have probable cause to believe that someone fits the criteria to be Baker Acted. If you don't have probable cause and you Baker Act them anyway, that's a Fourth Amendment violation. Clearly, the record in this case shows that Mr. Greer was going to be arrested. They'd never had physical custody of him prior to the actual shooting. They were trying to talk to him, reach him, contact him. But the shooting, unfortunately, occurred before they actually had physical custody of him. But it was clear that this was a situation where he was going to be arrested. In fact, my client, Deputy Carnes, who was 12 miles away writing a ticket and was called as an additional backup unit to bring his butterfly shield, arrived after Deputy Heyman arrived and after Officer Holstein was there. And certainly this was a case that occurred in the City of India Atlantic jurisdiction. Although Brevard County Sheriff's Office has jurisdiction throughout the entire county, in cities that have their own police department, their police departments police their cities. So my client and Mr. Bogan's clients were assisting Officer Holstein, who clearly testified after reaching out to a supervisor that he was going to arrest Mr. Greer had he been able to been controlled or peaceably came out of the house and or Baker Act him at some point after the time. So the 5.2 instruction that this court has in its pattern instructions, it's been around for a long time. We all use it all the time in all sorts of cases, whether they're pepper spray, handcuffing cases, shooting cases, taser cases, canine cases. And certainly there are times when you need to adapt them. In our proposed—
That's essentially his argument, because I don't think anybody is debating your first point, which is that the pattern instruction is generally a correct statement of the law. But his argument is that, in part, given what we decided in the first interlocutory appeal, and given the way the case played out, that it should have been adapted to be more finely tuned with the specifics of this case.
Well, and I think ultimately it was. As the court is aware, the record at trial is different from the record at the summary judgment stage, and the way you view the evidence is certainly different now that the case has been tried. And ultimately, on this record, what were they doing? I mean, what were Kinella and Heyman doing? They weren't there to bring him his prescription medication bottle, and even his brother, Randall Greer, called the police and said, my brother's assaulted me with a knife and he's choked my wife, his then wife. I mean, even Randall Greer didn't call the police and say, will you come Baker Act my brother? So they were there to enforce the criminal laws of the state of Florida when this force was used. And it was pretty obvious. And although candidly, I wasn't involved in this trial, my partner, Bruce Jolly, tried it. He's since retired over a year ago and his son left the firm and moved off to a different location. But the pattern instructions that the defense submitted, D353-10, and honestly, it does appear it was an oversight, but we use the word interaction with Christopher Greer because he could have been Baker acted or he could have been arrested or both. Either way, it's a seizure. And then, but on the next page, on page 26 to 33, the word arrest does appear. But regardless, Your Honors, ultimately, this is a case where the jury has determined, after hearing all of the evidence, and when you look at Greer 1, this court decided that the reasonableness determination turns on two questions. Was Christopher Greer holding a knife when he was killed? And if so, what was he doing with it? And the jury heard all of that evidence. They had the door. The actual door from the courtroom, from the garage, was in the courtroom. They looked at it at the end of the trial for several minutes, and then returned a defense verdict shortly thereafter. There was a hole through the door. It wasn't just a gouge. The knife blade went completely through both sides of the door, penetrating one side and out the other where the jacket was hanging. And so the jacket and the knife fell to the ground, and when the door was opened and Christopher Greer's body was there, the jacket, the knife, it all rolled itself up into a pile in the jacket. And the jury heard all of that evidence. They heard from Holstein. They heard that he couldn't see Christopher Greer's hands. He unequivocally testified that he's not saying there was a knife. He's not saying there was no knife. He's saying, I never saw his hands in that brief fraction of a second. He can't say one way or the other whether there was a knife. And so those issues that this court in Greer 1 determined needed to be tried were all addressed by way of the evidence in this case. And their verdict, I think, speaks loudly in favor of affirming. There's no harm here. And since this seems to be the primary issue we're discussing, I would urge the court to affirm this judgment. At a minimum, you should affirm on the 1983 claim. And if the state claim were remanded, all of these hurdles we're talking about would exist. I mean, going to the 768-289A defense, that doesn't come into play if there's no excessive force.
I know. You've gone over your time, so.
Okay.
Well, I think we've got your position, and everything you've said in the brief is certainly preserved as well.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Davis, you've got 3 minutes for rebuttal. A piece of advice, I would not try to address everything. I would pick an issue that you think merits your rejoinder and address that.
Well, if I can make a 15, I'm sorry. If I could just take 15 seconds just to correct the record. There was a significant factual dispute as to whether he was being taken into custody or arrested. And I think, Judge Jordan, you might remember from the original appeal, the officers immediately after the shooting told the FDLE, who was investigating the shooting, that they originally went in because they were concerned that Randall Greer's and Christopher Greer's old father was inside. And that was the reason why they went in. That's why they didn't wait for anyone. And of course, the FDLE found the audio of the conversations from before they went in that clearly established that the officers were fully aware that there was no one inside of the house, that his parents had died. And the jury was made aware of that, and that came out as impeachment evidence when only one of the officers said they went in to take him into custody, and it came out as impeachment. So it was nowhere near clear that they were going in for a lawful purpose, for an honest purpose to arrest him, to take him into custody. Regarding the question that was asked by the court, which is, does the verdict form include, does it basically get rid of the state law claims? And the answer is no, right? Remember, the verdict form merely reflects a jury determination that the estate did not prove by a preponderance of the evidence the elements of the claim. That does not foreclose another jury or the same jury saying that the defendant officers did not prove their claim or their affirmative defense by preponderance of the evidence. And I think that's
don't
the
you
answer.
Have to, don't you have to, it all, I think a lot of this comes down to regards to prejudice. It comes down to whether or not you have to prove that the use of force was unreasonable for your state law claims. Isn't that a burden you have to sustain?
No, Your Honor. Under the state law.
What do you have to show about the use of force to win on your battery claim?
So if they're alleging stand your ground immunity?
No.
No. Just the merits of the claim.
Let's assume there's no immunity. You sue a police officer for battery under state law. What do you have to prove?
You have to prove a harmful or offensive touching. That's
unreasonable.
Well, no, Your Honor. That if you look at the case law that we cite in our brief, that point is very clear. And the defendants do not make that argument either.
So you think that the standard for an offensive touching doesn't dovetail the standard for excessive force under the Fourth Amendment?
No, Your Honor. It's battery claim is whether you're suing an officer or suing the neighbor, the elements of battery are the same. It's the affirmative defense that comes affirmative defenses that bring this issue into play. And I want to make sure the court understands, if the court finds that the refusal to send the state law claims to the jury was not harmless, then that means that in every future civil rights case, the district courts can do this on their own motion.
I wouldn't take that assumption as a given, because I'm certainly going to try to explain as best as I can, regardless of what the ultimate result is here. And that's something we've got to talk about ourselves, of course, that this is not standard operating procedure. It's just the parties have chosen to try the state and federal claims together. They arise out of the same set of facts, and absent some extraordinary circumstances, they should be tried together and submitted to a jury together. But thank you very much, Mr. Davis. We appreciate the help. Mr. Bogan, Mr. Jafrida, thank you very much. All right, that wraps up our week. We are in recess.
All rise.
Oh, shoot.